Hello, everyone, and welcome to the With Chinese Characteristics podcast. I'm Natalie.
I'm Cherry.
And together we talk about topics with Chinese characteristics, whatever those might be. And today, Cherry, I think we're going to be talking more about pandas, aren't we?
We are.
So if you didn't catch it, last week's episode was on pandas, their early history, mankind's Chinese people's interactions with them, and the international panda trade. So what are we talking about this week, Cherry?
Well, we're going to talk about modern panda history.
Okay.
What happened after 1949.
After the Chinese people stood up.
Liberated. So in the late 1940s and early 1950s, panda exchange came to a halt after the brief exercise of panda diplomacy by the Republic of China government.
And when you say exchange, that's kind of in quotation marks, right? Because the Republic of China was giving pandas as gifts,
yeah,
for international recognition, but also people were still nabbing them.
The bloody history of panda trafficking.
Yeah.
So yeah, listen to our last episode if you want to hear about that fun topic.
Mm-hmm.
So when the nationalist government picked up and moved to Taiwan, they took a lot of stuff with them. Famously, the jade cabbage and the meat-shaped stone. Now, sitting in the National Palace Museum in Taipei.
National treasures, Cherry.
They didn't take any pandas with them, though.
Yeah. I want to see the meat-shaped stone because...
I do, too.
It really looks like a meat-shaped stone.
They did a good job.
Yeah.
So, before returning to the international trade of pandas, let's talk about how panda is doing domestically back in China.
Red China.
Exactly.
These are communist pandas now, Cherry.
Yeah. So, after 1949... the CCP government played a heavy hand in resource planning.
It's a bit of an understatement.
A heavy hand.
They were the only...
anything and everything.
They were the only hand.
Yeah, exactly. So this trickles down to what scientists can and should study.
Mm.
All scientific research in principle is guided by political agendas and must serve a political or economical purpose.
Mm.
So in 1956, a Chinese biologist wrote an article for the People's Daily. He said, "The pandas presently have a special function. Doing research on them can increase our respect for objectivity. The study of most natural sciences has this use, but it can be said to be especially true with the study of the panda."
Mm.
So the idea is that panda research is a tool for training the Chinese people, the masses, to embrace a more scientific way of thinking. Casual observation is not enough anymore. Methodical study and fields research needs to be introduced to the natural science field, and panda, having no preconceived symbolism of the old China, meaning the imperialist courts,
yeah,
is adorable in its appearances, is harmless, and therefore is the perfect candidate for this.
So this was part of the whole post-1950, I mean, you couldn't put dragons on things. Mm-mm. Or tigers, really. You know, some of these things had old notions. Even like zodiac animals kind of have some old
notions,
yeah,
associated with them. We're breaking everything old.
But, no, I mean, pandas are really old, but...
but not culturally speaking.
Yeah, no one really knew what they were. For, yeah. So basically they're saying nobody knows anything about pandas.
It's a piece of blank paper.
Yeah, we barely even know like what they eat, how they breed, all that kind of stuff.
Yes. And you know what? The Chinese government at this time, it hosted a lot of anti-superstition campaigns, and it does promote general better public health notions.
Mm-hmm.
So
we talked about that in the, you know, their public health campaigns.
Yes.
Some of them went a little bit off the rails.
Some of them did. But that was one of the objectives of the government.
Oh.
So panda was used as a perfect tool. And more importantly, was politically safe to study. And its popularity went beyond the science field as well. Artists and manufacturers learned that repping panda image is perfectly acceptable. And when we talk about how it was largely absent from traditional Chinese art artifacts,
yeah,
pandas, images of pandas, it quickly blew up during this period and it was everywhere. Artists who practice traditional Chinese brush painting can't really paint any traditional images anymore.
You can't paint like a palace or like a,
no,
you know, like a dragon boat or
like
something.
Like a garden. It's too like bourgeoisie, yeah, you know. So, but pandas were okay and even encouraged. The People's Daily published images of panda paintings by famous artists which is a signal that it was politically acceptable.
Well, it's almost like the revolutionary operas, which we talked about in the Taking Tiger Mountain.
Yeah.
Where it's like a traditional Chinese art, like, you know, brush painting. And they can't tell old stories with it or show old things.
Yeah.
But they're like, well, what new
what
thing
new can story we, can, yeah, what, can we... What revolutionary stories yeah. can we tell with this?
Yeah. And pandas are clearly a revolutionary animal, Cherry.
Exactly. And in 1963, pandas even got onto the postage, which is, you know, it's official now.
That's making it big. You're on a postage stamp.
Exactly. And the postage is not like a picture of panda. It's a paint. It's a Chinese brush style painting of panda eating bamboos. Mm. It's cute. So besides that, not just that it was acceptable, at a time when everything was inevitably political, political awareness and attentiveness is important, not only to the survival of the artwork, of the ideas, but also of the people behind those works and those ideas.
Mm.
So if you're someone who practices traditional Chinese brush painting or someone who makes art in general,
yeah,
which is already inherently a bourgeoisie behavior, you better align yourself with the correct subjects, which is
peasants,
pandas. Yeah. Or like draw a picture of people shooting birds.
Yeah.
The capitalist birds.
A rice field.
Yes. So this goes beyond the science and the art field. They were panda radios, panda TVs, panda branded condensed milk and butter, panda cigarettes. So you name it. Anything that China had just invented, and that is a pride and joy of the Chinese industries, we slap the brand panda on it.
Mm.
So interestingly though, even though pandas got its branding during these very political years in China, and its fame came to a peak during the Cultural Revolution, but nowadays people rarely associate panda with those times.
With Maoism.
With Maoism, right? And we don't see panda as something that needs to be reflected upon like we do with the Cultural Revolution or with Da Zibao, like, you know, the big letter, big character posters.
Yeah.
Or any of the cultural or art elements of the time.
Mm-hmm.
It does not even really remind us much of that time. It's a really useful political symbol precisely because of its ability to be apolitical.
So it can be whatever politics you want to use it for.
Yeah. And you can renew it the time goes on.
It's a blank slate.
Yeah. So
Maoist panda and Xi Jinping panda.
Exactly, right? So besides representing the modern ways of science and research, as well as repping Chinese brands and arts, panda has its most important job, which is to represent the Chinese identity and promote nationalism.
I was going to say eating bamboo, but I guess that's...
Well, it is very important for them to eat bamboo. They can't stop eating it because it's so calorie, so not calorie dense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, then the whole country will be covered in bamboo, Jerry. Pandas are keeping it back.
Yeah, right? So panda, which is supposedly a living fossil, 活化石, it has undergone an unusual lack of revolutionary change during its long existence.
Evolutionary change.
Oh, evolutionary. Revolutionary. Oh, I'm so sorry.
Revolutionary change is what China went through.
This is my thinking.
Yeah.
My Chinese thinking.
I know.
Yeah.
Everything's revolutions with you, Cherry.
Yes. So although so-called living fossils are not really that uncommon, you know, there's many like fishes, insects that predates dinosaurs.
I think cockroaches.
Cockroaches. Opossums, apparently some rock rat or like okapi.
Opossums.
Opossums.
Yeah.
What did I say?
I just was pronouncing it a little bit more clearly. I was giving some subtitles to the audience.
Why am I doing a podcast in English? Should make you do one in Chinese. So, but panda's cultural significance is tied to it being a living fossil, unlike the others.
Mm.
And when people refer to it as a living fossil, it's usually a very positive, amazing thing. You're supposed to respect a living fossil, you know, such amazing success. And at the same time, a mystery.
Mm.
And by that, I mean, it's China.
5,000 years of eating bamboo, Cherry.
Yes.
Probably more like 5 million years of eating bamboo.
Yes. But I mean, China being a living fossil in many ways, the longevity of panda as a symbol.
So they're basically, it's like they're trying to make it like a second Great Wall.
Yes.
If we got the Great Wall and we got pandas.
Yes, exactly. So quotes from the book Panda Nation, The Construction and Conservation of China's Modern Icon by E. Elena Sunster, which is a really book, which is a really good book.
Yeah.
I recommend it. And we'll put the link down in the show notes below. Quote, "The desire of present-day citizens to forge a sense of continuity between the territory of the present nation and the same region millions of years ago through the giant panda embodies one of the quintessential tensions of the modern nation. Legitimacy requires both a claim on the past and a break from it."
Mm.
Yeah. But then it's like, is panda even Chinese? Was my question.
Yeah.
Can we actually absolutely say it's Chinese?
They're kind of down there in the corner, aren't they?
Yeah. You mean China. In the southeast corner of China?
Yeah.
So according to WWF's website, World Wildlife Fund.
I always think it's funny because there's another organization, which is the World Wrestling Federation, which is also WWF.
Oh, it's not the other one.
No. The World Wildlife Fund is what we're talking about.
Yes. There's not much wrestling going on.
No.
Pandas passive.
Pandas wrestle.
You play around, yeah. I guess. Yeah. So even though now the panda's range is restricted to just 6 isolated mountains in south central China, wild giant pandas could once have been found throughout eastern and southern China, northern Vietnam, and northern Myanmar.
Mm.
And there are fossil discoveries in Burma, Thailand, and Vietnam.
Which makes sense. I mean, there's bamboo there and there's mountains there. It's not like they have Chinese citizenship. They can't cross the border.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, the border was blurry at times
throughout
history. So it shifts and moves around, you know. But China, us, we don't like to promote that. We sort of downplay it. And, you know, we sometimes call it an opinion. Whether this panda skull that you found is actually the panda.
Whether these remain.
Or it's like a different branch of the species,
even
therefore not the panda.
Even though it's a living fossil and hasn't changed in.
Exactly. Many years.
Okay.
Yeah. It's all, we got to keep up.
So it's not a
uniquely. We got to keep up with the narrative.
So they're only still in China, right? But it's not, historically, it's almost certainly not it wasn't uniquely limited to the territory of what is now China.
Yes.
Okay.
Also, and China didn't exist when panda started existing.
Yeah.
The modern.
No, it did, Cherry. It's the spirit of.
Okay.
Chinese people.
Okay. So yeah, that sums up panda's status domestically in the first 30, 40 years.
So it's a rock star.
It's a rock star.
Okay.
Even though rock stars weren't allowed in China.
Well, they pandas
Mao would
allowed.
Be the rock star, but you know, pandas is okay.
Mao and pandas.
So let's talk about panda diplomacy next. So the first panda that crossed the state line to another country after 1949, that we know of, because there's a black market for these things, was in 1957.
So wait, were there any, so by the 1950s, like, let's say, were all the pandas dead worldwide, or were there still a couple hanging around?
They didn't live very long if they were a couple hanging around.
Okay.
And I think by the 1960s, all, like, pandas in America has died.
Mm.
So.
I said panda diplomacy. I'm imagining, like, a panda in a suit signing a treaty.
That is.
I'm guessing that's not what we're going to talk about.
That is not exactly how it works.
Okay.
But I wouldn't say it's too far apart.
Okay.
Sometimes. So. The first panda that crossed the state line to another country after 1949 that we know of was in 1957, when China gifted a panda to Soviet Union in celebration of the 40th year anniversary of the October Revolution.
Wow.
Which happened in 1917, which, if you didn't know, it was officially known as the Great October Socialist Revolution, which was an important event that eventually led to the larger Russian Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
So these are red pandas we're talking about.
Yeah.
So apparently, there were two that were initially sent in 1957, even though when you read books and research or reports on it, lots of them say just one. It's actually because one of them got sent back really quickly because the Soviet Union thought they were the same sex.
Okay.
So the idea is that you send a pair of pandas so they can breed and keep each other company and then be a couple, live happily ever after in
assuming
a cold land. Far away from home in Moscow.
Assuming they get along. Which
assuming
we found
they get along.
Is not
which
guaranteed.
Is not a given. So they sent one back. So in 1959, another panda, An-An, was sent to the Soviet Union as a replacement. There are many different accounts on who got the sex wrong and like what sex was got wrong. Was it a female or thought to be a female, but it turned out to be a male panda, or was it vice versa?
Is it hard to tell like what gender a panda is?
Well, I thought it wouldn't be unless it's a baby panda, but apparently, apparently a adult male panda's
genitals
are very small.
reproductive organs,
they're very small, and it's just really hard to tell, and nowadays sometimes they have to do genetic tests to find out. And you know, a panda's big, and these years like they were not doing research on pandas. There was no comprehensive...
Well, this is why that Chinese guy had to write that letter. He's like, we don't even know how to tell what gender they are. Like,
yeah, well, we think they're this, but the Russians think it's otherwise, you know. So they sent one back, and then we'll send another one. But I'm not going to go to the details in that, besides telling you this. In the end, Soviet Union ended up with two male pandas. It didn't matter anyway, since the first panda sent, Ping Ping, failed to adjust to the cold weather of Moscow and dying only after three years.
That's so sad.
Very sad.
I'm imagining, though, I mean, like, they're probably like, it's big, it's fat, it's furry, it'll be fine in the winter.
Yes.
But it's like a tropical animal.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. I think we have no idea whether it actually, because it was too cold, or they just don't really know how to put, like,
feed it and stuff.
Feed it, and these pandas were just not living in great conditions to be, didn't have great care. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But, like, saying it as cold weather seems to be the weather is always the scapegoat, you know?
Yeah.
It's too cold.
Yeah. It seems like everybody was losing pandas. Like, nobody knew how to properly take care of pandas. So it wasn't a uniquely Russian problem.
Well, it was a uniquely human problem.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Human greed problem.
Yeah. So, Cherry, there's no greed in communism. This was a pure expression of
exchange.
Comradeship.
Exactly.
For the October Revolution.
Yeah. So the panda that got sent back by the Soviet Union was renamed in Chinese. Previously, it was Qi Qi, and it was named to Ji Ji. And in English, its name is just Qi Qi.
Why did they need to change the name?
I think maybe because they thought it was embarrassing that they sent the panda back.
So they're like money laundering the panda?
I don't know. It's the same panda. Like, I've read so many accounts, it's the same panda.
Like renaming a boat.
And the renaming was not a secret either. So,
okay.
You know, in 1958, an Austrian...
Australian or Austrian?
Austrian in Europe.
Oh, okay.
Animal broker. Okay, you know what? They're a small country, but they count, okay?
Well, Hitler was from there, so big impact on the world right there.
Yeah, so this has just gotten to a very heavy episode, if it wasn't heavy enough. So this animal broker acquired Qi Qi from Beijing Zoo in exchange for a collection of African animals, which
so
apparently were three giraffes, two rhinos, and some other animals.
So it's the same secondhand Russian panda.
Yeah, it's the same secondhand Russian panda they didn't want,
okay,
which is a female panda. Turned out.
It's like, hey, you want some zebras? You want some whatever? What was it? Giraffes, you said?
Three giraffes, two rhinos, and some other animals.
Okay.
So the background is that zoos in China at this time mostly displayed domestic animals, unlike zoos in Europe and America.
Yeah, well, how are they going to get...
Exactly.
The Republic of China Navy is off there at the coast sinking anything it can get its hands on.
Yeah.
So.
Probably the giraffes and rhinos seem pretty exotic, and the Beijing Zoo probably thought it was a good deal.
Yeah.
And then the London Zoo bought Qi Qi from the animal broker for 12,000 pounds.
Okay.
She then went to Moscow twice throughout her life as attempts to mate with the male panda An An, which is the one that had replaced her and got sent to Soviet Union.
Okay. This is all very incestuous.
And,
okay.
Yeah. Small world. There's not that many of them around, you know?
Okay.
So, but no success there.
Well, because you said earlier, like, they're only fertile for, like...
A couple days of the year. And you really have to find the right, you know... In nature, they have choices. They have time to prepare for this.
Mm.
They have groups of pandas that just go around and, like, gather and find the mates they prefer, I guess. So in this case, there was no success, but she lived a pretty long life until 1972 for 17 years and died in London.
There's this reputation that we talked about in the first, but the pandas are like bad breeders. They're not. It's just that they can only do it a couple times a year. And if you don't know anything about pandas...
Once a year.
Once a year. The odds of you getting two pandas together, that are the right age and compatible and are like...
Is very low,
right?
Also, it's not like they can do it whenever they want.
But there's not going to be any babies.
The female panda only ovulates once a year.
Yeah, so there's not going to be any kids.
Yes. And so it's not like pandas are as good as reproducing as like rabbits or like cats. But generally, they are okay. Generally, they only have one. But if there are twin pandas, one of them will get either abandoned or just won't survive because the mother won't be able to take care of it.
Because I'm guessing it's just that bamboo is so, you know, it's basically wood.
There's it's not a lot of work.
There's not a lot of energy you can get from bamboo to make milk.
It's a lot of work, yeah. Uh-huh. I don't know, does panda milk?
Yeah, they're mammals.
Okay. All mammals milk?
That's what makes them mammals.
Oh, okay. All right. So, I'm going to delete that.
No, keep it.
So, yeah. So, no luck for Chi-Chi and Anne. Chi-Chi lived for 17 years. That was considered pretty long. Mm-hmm. At the time, pandas generally live around 20 years in the wild, and nowadays they can live up to 30 years in captivity. And the oldest panda in captivity of record has lived 38 years.
Okay. Makes sense, though, there's not that many of them, though, because even like if the stars align,
yeah.
If you have a boy panda and a girl panda, you know, how many baby pandas could they make in their 20-year lifespan? You know, like five, maybe four? Right, so it's like...
Well, I don't know.
They're only live till 20. They're only going to be fertile for some middle time, right? They only have can only have one kid per year.
Presumably.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's not a lot of...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, China also sent two pandas to North Korea in 1965 and two more in 1971 as, quote, replacements. That means the previous two did not live that long. So, as for America... We all know about Nixon's trip to China in 1972. China gifted two pandas to the American people. But before that, though, there were interests from American zoos already. And apparently, China wanted to export pandas to America and really did make some efforts. But it was all blocked. And in 1972...
Blocked by who?
America. The American government.
Because they're communist pandas or what?
Yeah, because they were red pandas.
Okay.
So in 1972, when America finally welcomed two pandas, an article in New York Times titled "A China Doll and Pal Came to Town," meaning the two pandas. The article started with, "Chi-Chi, the giant panda, might have been an American citizen had not the government..."
This is the same panda that got passed around. Chi-Chi is still...
Yeah, Chi-Chi lived a very legendary life.
Okay.
Chi-Chi's very famous.
She's in London right now at this point.
Well, I mean, she's gone, but yes, okay. Her remainings are...
Okay.
She has been stuffed. Yeah, so anyways, Chi-Chi is now a stuffed exhibit at the Natural History Museum in London.
They love stuffing pandas there.
They do. So Chi-Chi, the New York Times article started with, "Chi-Chi, the giant panda, might have been an American citizen had not the government banned her entry in the late 1950s as, quote, a product of communist China, quote. Instead, she flourished and continued to flourish as the pride of London Zoo."
Mm.
So, you know, some shade being thrown in there.
We missed out.
Yeah. So the two pandas that were gifted to America got the fancy diplomatic treatment. They were transported on a U.S. Air Force plane, and they landed in Washington, D.C. under the kind of security precautions tendered to visiting heads of a state.
Well, yeah, you can't let them out of your sight, Chair. They're communists.
Yeah, exactly.
They're communist pandas.
So the pandas went to Washington's National Zoo, and another New York Times article, and this is where I say our New York Times subscription really pays for itself, because there's archives of anything and everything in every single day, and you can go in there and read the... you know, the scans of the newspapers on the day. So
this isn't sponsored by the New York Times.
It's not.
But it could be. Yeah.
So March 15, 1972, the wire says, "The city of Washington has made up for the loss of its baseball team by gaining a pair of pandas." Not a bad exchange, considering that pandas are rare and highly prized, while the Senators finished the season in second to last place. And apparently the Senators, I was a bit confused, given that I'm not a sports person, don't know about American football.
You mean baseball?
Baseball, don't know about baseball. It's the Washington Senators is the team.
Well, I don't think they exist anymore because I've never heard of them. So I guess they were, I guess well, they were that bad.
Well, in 1972, they finished the season in next to last place. Yeah, well, so no, not that great.
Maybe that's why they're not around anymore.
Yeah. So
Senators just don't seem that like athletic of people by and large.
No.
Bad mascot for your team.
Right. So
they're all like 90.
That's so funny.
Tough crowd, okay?
Kamala Harris was only like, when she was a senator, it was only, what, in her 50s?
You know, that's pretty old for baseball, Jared. I'm pretty sure a 50-year-old.
Who's the youngest senator? Let's look it up.
When that's someone you're bringing up, it's like, no, we got some young people there in their 50s. They're in their 50s. Maybe that proves my point.
Youngest senator. Oh, yeah, John Ossoff, the Georgia one.
Okay, how old's he?
34.
Okay, well, you know, he can be there.
He can play baseball at 34. Okay,
well, one person doesn't make a baseball team.
So, at least four other major city zoos tried to get the two pandas that were presented, but Nixon chose the National Zoo on the ground that he accepted the gift on behalf of all the American people. The animals are accustomed, after all, to the status of people's pandas. It goes on to say, several disappointed zoo directors intend to ask Beijing officials for pandas of their own.
Okay.
A backlog demand for these attractive creatures have been suddenly simulated by the current vogue of all things Chinese.
So it's like video cards. Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
There's a waiting list.
Yes.
Pandamania is back on. Back on the menu, Cherry.
But pandas are an endangered species.
Yeah, whatever.
And the Washington pair are not likely to launch a panda population explosion. Happy result, though, that would be of the new Sino-American detente. So apparently, during their times at the National Zoo, the two pandas had 5 cubs, but none of them survived after a few days.
Oh.
So no, they did not launch a panda population explosion in America.
5 little sticks of butter.
Yeah. So if you listen to the last episode, that's how big a panda is when it's born, a stick of butter, apparently. And they also cannot tell the gender of the panda. And it's always a big thing that like the San Diego Zoo had like a panda baby and everyone just holding their breath waiting for the genetic test.
I don't think everyone's holding their breath.
No,
I think I think a lot of people don't really care.
No, but like people care about pandas. You know, it was a big thing that they announced the gender after genetic testing. They're like, we know for sure.
I'll take your word for it.
Yeah. There's a lot of enthusiasm, okay? You're a panda hater.
Everyone.
In the whole universe.
Yeah, everyone in the whole universe is holding their breath.
So, in the circumstances, Dr. William G. Conway, director of the Bronx Zoo, spoke wisely in trying to discourage his colleagues from
Is this still from the New York Times article?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
From vying for additional pandas. Keeping endangered animals in zoos is admirable if the choice is between that and probable extinction. But as long as they still have a chance to survive in the wild, it is better to protect them in their native habitat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Every panda you scoop out of a bamboo forest is one less panda that's having babies.
Out in the wild.
And they don't
and
really.
Living its life.
And they don't really know how to make them breed in captivity yet.
Exactly. So we're going to get into that in a second, because that's actually a big like conflict and dilemma between different parties on, you know, what we think we should do for pandas or not do to pandas. But back to the American side, it was not all singing and dancing, the gift and a recipient of these two pandas, because the tension between the two countries don't just disappear magically like that. And some Americans feared that China was going to trick them and send two pandas of the same sex. Because apparently we did do that. Allegedly. We did, you know,
not on purpose,
people
though.
Get confused.
Yeah.
Not on purpose. But this was not true. There were 2 18-month-old pandas, 1 female, 1 male, did produce some
cubs,
little pandas that didn't survive. But they arrived eventually on April 16, 1972. So the U.S. gifted China 2 musk oxens in return. And apparently, this raised some eyebrows.
I take
like you just did.
Yeah, I take the pandas.
Some argued that bisons would be a better represent.
Well, bisons are in danger too at this
time.
Well,
I know, but you know, maybe that's why it would be better to send them to match the status. But yeah, some argued that bisons would be better representatives of America. Musk oxen was not as exciting as pandas.
Maybe bald eagles.
But I mean, I don't think you keep them in captivity.
Bald eagles?
Yeah. Do you breed them?
You can keep them in captivity.
It's inhumane. Well, they belong to the sky.
Yeah, sure.
Freedom.
Yeah.
They're an American animal. They deserve freedom. Why am I advocating for this? And apparently, Harrison E. Salisbury, which is
did he invent the steak?
No, but he is an American journalist and the first regular New York Times correspondent in Moscow after World War II. Okay. So he was on the ground in the red part of the world.
Our man in Moscow.
Yeah. And he had dinner with Song Qingling, the vice chairman of the People's Republic of China, Sun Yat-sen's widow, father of the country, a few months after this panda exchange. He wrote for the New York Times on June 3rd, 1972. He said, "She took a cigarette from a green box. It was a panda-branded cigarette. She said, very mild, all Virginia tobacco and no sweetening or preservatives." So these are organic, you know, organic cigarettes.
These are healthy cigarettes.
Yeah, Cherry. Healthy cigarettes. It's got a panda on the box.
They cure cancer.
Yes. So, and she said that reminded her of the pandas in the Washington Zoo and of the musk oxen in the Beijing Zoo, which still have not been exhibited because they're suffering from a skiing ailment. She said, "We got a bad deal," with a laugh. That's Nixon for you. So, you know, pretty candid. But, you know, we kept them. It's fine. It went on exhibition later. The skiing ailment was treated. Yeah, but I mean, America milked those pandas. The National Zoo was so popular. And,
yeah. I'm sure they made some money.
Taxing generator. So the question I had was that why is panda preservation and wildlife preservation important in general? Which obviously we know it is, right? But here's the children's version for me and for you, our listeners. According to WWF's Living Planet report 2018, we have seen an astonishing 60% decline in the size of populations of mammals, birds, fish, reptiles, and amphibians in just over the past 40 years. Humans are behind the current rate of species extinction, which is at least 100 to 1,000 times higher than the nature had intended.
Because some animals are just going to go extinct on their own every couple of years, and there's going to be new species that
it's part
created.
Of the part of the circle of life.
Okay.
But just like global warming or wildfire, right?
Yeah.
We're accelerating it. So the human population has grown exponentially over the past 200 years. This growth and development also endangers the habitat and existence of many types of wildlife around the world. In addition, people started to realize that unrestricted killing and pollution for food, fashion, and commerce and manufacturing was destroying irreplaceable resources. Preserving and protecting panda means protecting the environment it inhabits, meaning to invest in all that surrounds a panda and what matters to its natural habitat.
So to keep a panda alive, you got to keep a healthy bamboo forest, which lots of other animals live in. And
And which in turn helps with the eco balance of the local environment. So by protecting panda and other species, you eventually, you know, you ultimately save
a lot more
the earth.
Yeah.
And the problem, or maybe it's not the problem, but the process of this, the concept and the practice of wildlife preservation, is inevitably political, because organizations like the WWF and many others have to work with governments worldwide or institutions worldwide in order to achieve their goals. Because
there's money involved, right? I mean, there's a habitat that has some animal in it, I mean, obviously the government's going to be like, well, let's bulldoze it and sell it. We'll make a bunch of money.
Yeah.
So there has to, you know, you have to convince them not to do that.
Yeah, exactly. So they help write legislations. They work with law enforcement to prosecute wildlife crimes.
Poachers and traffickers and stuff.
Yeah, and they help organize scientific research efforts and to help raise awareness worldwide, which all of these are going to be political.
Yeah.
And it's only more political when we are talking about panda, which is an animal that not only just endangered, by the way, it's no longer endangered apparently, it's vulnerable now. So that's good. Good news.
Congratulations, pandas.
Congratulations. But, you know, panda is world famous as well. And like no other, it represents a nation.
So it's an intensely,
political process.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there were many conflicts and struggles between political ideologies, like America Zoos were interested in pandas,
yeah,
and Joe McCartney wasn't okay with it. I mean, see, I say that, I wrote that, and I was like, maybe I shouldn't say that because he didn't actually make a speech about panda, but it was the Red Scare and the whole...
Yeah, anti-communist.
Anti-communist rhetoric that stops trade from China, right?
Yeah.
So there was conflicts there, and there's conflicts between the Chinese government and organizations like WWF.
Yeah.
And there's also conflicts between political entities everywhere, which would include WWF. In many ways, it is a very political entity, mm-hmm. or it cannot escape that, right? So they have their own agendas as an institution. And there are also other political entities, such as Western politicians, who knows that bringing a panda to their
constituents
can earn them a lot of brownie points.
And money and jobs. And
money and jobs and tax, you know, incomes and and write-ups in the newspapers. The conflicts between those institutions and politicians and animal rights activists and scientists is also a pretty big deal.
Mm.
Looking into the WWF's efforts in China, I feel like it really summarizes some of these struggles.
Difficulties, yeah.
Yeah. So in 1979, WWF reached out to China, which was a timely move because the Cultural Revolution has just ended. The period of eliminating chaos has begun.
And returning to normalcy.
Returning to normalcy. And in the previous year, China had just announced the four modernizations. So, you know, we went from four pests to now four modernizations, which were agriculture, industry, defense, and science. And China even initiated a panda study the year before, building a field camp in the Wanglong Reserve in the Sichuan province.
Mm.
So China agreed to a WWF visit, and WWF sent its delegates. And a China-WWF joint committee was formed with three members from each side, and understandings were signed, including an agreement to develop a project on conservation of the giant panda. So the delegations enjoyed 3 weeks of Chinese banquets hosted by the Chinese government. Then they all sat down and began serious negotiations to put the agreement onto the paper.
Mm.
And the details below were from the book The Last Panda by Dr. George Schaller, who is a German-born American biologist, conservationist, and author. And he was the first Western scientist to be entrusted with leading WWF work in China. And he has made a lot of breakthroughs in the study of panda ecology and behavior, forming the basis of panda knowledge and research for years to come. This book I also recommend, unlike the book we talked about in the last
episode. What's it called?
It's called The Last Panda.
Oh, okay.
He studies more than pandas. He studies all sorts of animals, and he's written other books. But I think he felt strongly about pandas.
Okay.
So, in the previous general agreement between WWF and China, it was mentioned that the project would include establishment of a research center on the species and systematic research on its biology. Now, the WWF's mistake was agreeing to this without any details at all. Because as soon as the serious discussions began, the Chinese officials made it clear that this was their highest priority, and they talked for several hours in great detail about what would become of this research center.
Okay.
The research laboratories will comprise 800 square meters and about 20 rooms. The cost of construction will be about 250 yuan per square meter. The living quarters will consist of 600 square meters. An associate professor will receive 70 square meters of living space. A technician, 30 square meters. There will be about 30 scientists and technicians. And, the research laboratories will be on the side of the river, the enclosure on the other. A bridge will cost 300,000 yuan. It will require 5 kilometers of fencing, 3 meters high, 2,500 poles at cost of 10 yuan per pole.
So nothing in there about pandas.
No. And that's great. That's like extremely detailed construction plan, right?
Yeah.
So as the Chinese side was announcing this, the WWF side was stunned.
Yeah.
And they were like, what did a big laboratory have to do with panda conservations? Even though they did say, we can have a research center, you know? Yeah. And they're like, why are we deciding on floor space and numbers of staff before we even had any discussions of what kind of research we could do with about pandas?
Yeah.
Dr. Schaller wrote, I did not know then that in China, the size of a building, no matter how inappropriate, makes a statement about a project's importance.
Yeah, well, I feel like that's a thing about public works projects in general. When people go like, what did you spend the money on? If you have a big building,
yeah,
you can go like here. There. Yeah. There. That's what we spent the money
or
on.
Something to show for.
This big building.
Yes. And so WWF was like, the emphasis should be on field work. Our goal is to prevent further decline in the numbers of pandas.
Did they speak like that in that like Valley Girl?
Exactly. Well, I'm just trying to show their like stunned. Okay, maybe I'll change my.
No, it's fine.
No.
No, we're keeping it. The WWF's like, oh my God.
Yeah.
We got to talk about pandas.
That's their inner monologue, you know? And they thought increased numbers through, their goal was to increase numbers through field research and captive breeding, the goal of which is to release the pandas back into the wild and also at the same time supply zoos.
So is WWF looking at it like, there's such a small breeding population, mm-hmm. anything we do needs to be just to make more pandas?
Yeah. And the China was like, yes, agreed. However, really the pandas are for supplies and we want more supplies than you've ever imagined to send as diplomats worldwide.
Okay. So they're like, we're going to breed them and sell them basically.
Yeah. Our goal is not to have them live happily ever after in the wild. And
it's to utilize this national resource.
Exactly. So the Chinese side said, a research center is needed to coordinate all panda work. Without such a center, other units will not cooperate. The first step is the construction of a research center. I don't know how many different ways they can say it.
Yeah.
Say the same thing. And his message, meaning the Chinese official's message, was clear. No research center, no panda project. So the WWF was still struggling here, right? They're still like hopeless struggling, really. So they said, we raise money from the public. It is not a bank. The public does not like to pay for facilities, which I guess could be true.
Yeah. Especially not a facility that's going to be owned by the Chinese government.
Exactly. To Dr. Schaller's observation, WWF began the project with romanticism and naivete, even though they did bring their PR director to the negotiation, by the way, if you look at who they sent. So WWF's thought, quote, was not a shared commitment to the panda enough. Other countries had accepted with gratitude whatever WWF had offered in terms of funds and equipment. The Chinese have long perceived that foreigners always serve their own interests, whether they are bestowing gifts or taking something. The Chinese do not confuse material interests with other goals, as at any rate, WWF was underprepared for hard negotiation. Quote. So obviously I have some sympathies, but at the same time, WWF needs this project to work. They have raised all this money. They have sold it to their constituents and their donors that we're going to do this great thing. And there's a Chinese saying, which was used by again, Dr. Schaller in his book, which I thought was excellent. He said, the Chinese proverb, 骑虎难下, meaning when riding a tiger, it's difficult to get off.
It's like you got
That's the WWF.
It's like you got the bull by the horns.
Exactly. And obviously the Chinese side could be seeing this as a zero-sum game.
Yeah.
Right?
We got to get as much out of these WWF people as possible.
Yes. Otherwise, they're going to trick us. Also, like, why would you believe their only interest is for the good of the pandas?
Yeah.
They have their own agenda, which they do. But yeah, it was a hard negotiation. And the other problem is that WWF also brought out all of its big guns to every round of negotiations, its top officials, while the Chinese side used mid-level bureaucrats to hash out the details.
It's like the Opium War.
Yeah, which is a smart negotiation move that allows for more wiggle room, more face-saving opportunities.
And then you can always agree to stuff and then go back a couple of days later and go, actually, the person really in charge said no, so we're not going to do that.
Yeah, so it was very frustrating. But anyhow, at the end, WWF folded. They agreed to contribute $1 million to construction. But apparently in written, the Chinese side changed it to at least $1 million. Coordinations between conservation organizations and authorities in China and WWF would begin soon.
Okay.
So Dr. Schaller later said in his book, the Panda Project was the most difficult of all my studies. Not because of any inherent problems in the research, which was easy in conception and execution, but because it was conducted under the auspices of two bureaucratic institutions, the Chinese government, with its vast hierarchical structure from the highest level in Beijing to the lowest level in our camp, and the World Wildlife Fund International. far removed in Switzerland from the pandas, yet determined to control the local situation. The two institutions understood the enterprise imperfectly and misunderstood each other frequently. And he had spent years in many other places, Pakistan, India, Brazil, you know, studying wildlife and dealing with local officials on many different levels.
Yeah.
But I do, you know, I can't imagine how frustrating it is for him. He does say a biologist must not study nature, but also induce action on behalf of a conservation. And this guarantees problems for any subject. It's not, you can't do this in a vacuum.
You have to be a politician too.
And you have to be realistic, right? So that was interesting.
So I'm assuming that period, like the late 70s, early 80s, mm-hmm. is when China started to get serious about panda conservation.
So yes, it is. I think things are moving towards the right direction. Mm. And they did get much better at breeding pandas and keeping them in captivity, live a happy long life. So between 1957 to 1983, China gave away a total of 24 pandas to 9 countries officially, as official diplomatic gifts.
And there's not that many pandas, so that's like probably like, I mean, that could be like,
it's everything
10% or something of every, you know what I mean? There's only like, maybe I think even now there's only like 1,000 pandas or something like
in
that.
In captivity. Well, like you said, you know, there's not that many. There's a limited supply to go around.
Yeah.
So in 1984, China modified the policy. Pandas won't be gifts anymore, but they can only be loaned from this point on.
Okay.
In principle. So beginning with China presenting 2 pandas to Los Angeles, USA, during the 1984 Olympic Games for $50,000 per panda per month, which is pretty good money, you know? The practice was again modified in 1991 in favor for long-term loans, so like 10 years at a time. And the standard loan terms include a fee for up to $1 million US per year. Little baby pandas, panda cubs, born during the loan period would be the property of the People's Republic of China.
Well, they got a monopoly, Cherry. They can set the terms.
Right, exactly. So this had raised some eyebrows, obviously.
Yeah.
Not that, you know, China is have a duty to send give pandas to other countries, but
I'm just thinking, like, China's ahead of the game here. Like, it's like software and is all subscription based now.
Yeah,
like
SaaS.
Software as a service.
Panda SaaS.
This is Panda as a service.
Yeah, exactly. Obviously, A, it generates really good income. B, it's like it makes it very competitive because there's, again, limited amounts of them to go around, and you can only get them for 10 years.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of agreements written in. The panda comes with a whole team. Biologists, Chinese scientists.
And you got to pay for the team.
You have to agree. You got to pay for the team. You have to agree to all these terms. Pandas must be. I mean, it's good that they ask for pandas to be housed in a suitable situation. Yeah. All well taken care of. You got to go by the rules now. But this puts the pandas in the situation of being show animals, as if they weren't before. But you know, this sort of enhances it. So.
Because if you're paying $1 million a year for a panda, you got to make that money back. Right, if you're a zoo or something, right?
Yeah. And thanks again to Dr. Schaller's book. Here's some insights from the legal fights in America over this panda loan practice.
Mm.
To be fair, some zoos, as New York and Calgary. To be fair, some zoos, as New York and Calgary, did not want pandas, but their municipal governments decided otherwise.
It's jobs, Cherry.
Yeah, it's jobs. It's votes. Tax money. It's tax income. China was hurting its hearts and minds, Natalie. It's hearts and minds. China was hurting its image in the conservation community by seemingly using the panda for mercenary goals. And I was like, oh, well, we had a better reputation. That's good to know. But however, as one official from China, Wildlife Conservation Association explained, there's no question of the price, but we welcome a donation. As long as the donation is $1 million US. So, Dr. Schaller had...
It's like when you visit the emperor, you got to give a certain amount of gifts, quote unquote.
Yeah. So, Dr. Schaller had anticipated the trends in rentals. In 1985, he wrote to the American Association of Zoological Parks and Aquariums to suggest that certain guidelines for accepting short-term loans be prepared. For example, recently captured individuals would be returned quickly to the wild, and China would initiate a coordinated breeding program instead of keeping animals scattered and alone in many zoos.
Mm.
And that pandas with reproductive potential should not be exposed to the stress of a tour and be deprived of the opportunity to mate. And to their credit, the AAZPA did agree, took up the advice, and produced excellent guidelines covering everything from traveling to housing, and urged its members to accept only animals that are sterile or past breeding age.
Okay. However, because if it's a, because if a panda can't have babies anymore, then it's like, why not send it to a zoo, right? It's not hurting the conservation effort.
Yes. Disclaimer here, it's not just America that's importing pandas,
yeah,
but America is a huge market.
And has, and I think it's, and has very, the money to pay for these
rentals. Has the money to pay for it, and it's interesting. So, you know, we're going to use America as a sample here,
yeah,
as the lens into this whole practice. So the Chinese had not been consulted by, you know, these guidelines.
Yeah.
Because obviously America is making rules what it can import.
Yeah.
But we're like, you got to talk to us too. Quote, Dr. Schaller, the New York Zoological Society, for example, was shipped a wild-caught adult female who, according to the Chinese, was incapable of breeding. And shortly after...
Some Chinese guy's like, yeah, yeah, it's fine, it's sterile, whatever.
Yes. Shortly after, she came into heat. The male sent with her was too young to breed and so much smaller than the female that he was kept separate from her because they were scared that she might injure him. And, quote, the lung of these pandas were an embarrassment for the New York Zoological Society, which more than any other such institution had contributed to the conservation of pandas and wildlife in general, end quote.
So that's the exact opposite of what they're trying to do, is taking two pandas off the market, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. And apparently the director of the Calgary Zoo was offered a pair, yeah, of pandas, and he had to write back to China and be very stern about, we cannot accept these because they're not sterile.
Mm.
You know, not that you should sterilize them, but like,
yes,
send us other pandas or we can't take these pandas.
Yes.
And the China, you know, eventually agreed. But it's just funny that they had to put that in writing.
Yeah.
So with all these legal fights, and once again, the American institutions, they're not just fighting with the Chinese institutions who will send whatever. They're also fighting local politicians who really want these pandas.
Mm-hmm.
And they would want them at zoos. They would want them at exhibits or like county fairs, which is completely commercial, obviously. You can't do any scientific research there.
Yeah.
And they will sue each other. Like the county fair will be blocked of a panda import that had the Chinese counterpart had agreed, and they will sue the American institutions who had, you know, like lobbied for the banning, or the government, the banning of the import, mm, saying that, again, this is America, you can sue anyone for anything, but they will sue for economic losses because the panda would have generated a lot of money for the county fair, and now we want that money back from you, the money that we could have made with the panda. Yeah. So the
conservation and zoo groups, for the most part, and animal, mm-hmm, groups, they're looking at the long term.
Yeah.
They're like, we want there to still be pandas in 100 years.
Yes.
Meanwhile, local politicians...
And they have a different understanding of like what animals' rights are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And local politicians are like, well, I want to get elected next year.
Yeah.
So we need to get that panda here.
Since 1998, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service only allows a U.S. zoo to import a panda if the zoo can make sure that China, the party that accepts the money, will channel more than half of its loan fee into conservation efforts for wild pandas and their habitat.
Which is impossible to verify.
And here's the problem. Yeah, here's the problem with the money, because they go to China, right? And it's, you know, everyone goes, it's a good thing that we're, you know, these donations, because they go into the preservation of the pandas and its habitat.
And it's
impossible to audit.
Yeah.
And the Chinese, we're not happy. We don't want to give you any information more than we have to.
Yeah.
Right?
We can't even get, you know, there's...
And there are different separate institutions in China that can grant panda loans. And so the internal politics is also very complicated.
I mean, they can't even get companies listing on the U.S. stock exchange to properly disclose their financials. Like they're going to get some random local government agency in Sichuan province to
exactly. And you know, it all feels like playing house to me in a way, because obviously $1 million is a lot of money,
and that was 1985, you said.
Yes.
So it's probably more now.
Well, it is a lot of money. However, I would argue it's not a lot of money for China as a country, for the government controls everything.
Yeah.
The government, when it wants to get something done, it will get something done. Like, did anyone ever question if the Beijing Olympics, like, made money or lost money? So if the Chinese government wants to preserve pandas, they will preserve pandas.
Yeah.
And, like, $1 million is a drop in the bucket.
It's probably a lot of money for those local areas,
though. It's a lot of money for the local areas. And but you don't know if it went to the local areas. And, you know, it's a lot of money for the local officials.
Yeah.
And their fancy cars and their dinners. So, and their Chinese banquets. So, the Chinese side, expectedly, why would you think otherwise? If you're, quote-unquote, Chinese expert.
Is a black box.
Yeah, it's a black box. We're not going to produce any receipts. So, I think reluctantly they did at times, but so the whole we only loan out pandas on a 10-year loan and all that stuff, that's just the principle. You don't always have to follow it. After the 2008 Sichuan earthquake that severely damaged many facilities, 60 pandas apparently required new housing.
Okay.
And the majority of them was then just given to nations that had favorable trade agreements with China. As an example, Iranian from Australia. You know. Not on paper.
I'm imagining
but that,
like
they gave some.
A trade in like civilization.
Yes.
You're like, I have pandas, you have uranium.
Yeah.
Let's make a trade.
Yeah. Or like, if you give us uranium, in six months, we can give you a panda. You know? Yeah. They need housing for these pandas anyways. They have nowhere to go. So yeah, highly political. And you can't avoid it. And another incident I want to briefly talk about, because this episode is getting too long anyways. This event probably deserves its own episode. Is that China had offered pandas to Taiwan.
Mm.
And when China offers pandas to other countries or regions, that's not called a China, another China, it's usually a good thing. That's well received locally, right? Like,
yeah.
Even though, you know, animal activists might have a problem with it, but like the people generally love panda. They want to go to zoos and look at panda. They think it's so cute.
They're fun.
Yeah, they're fun. Winning hearts and minds everywhere. But the whole sending a pair of pandas to Taiwan was highly controversial. Like
on which side?
Well, on the Taiwan side.
Okay.
Of course not on the Chinese side.
Why didn't
side.
They want the panda?
Well, here's the problem, right? So
also, what year was this?
2005.
Okay.
Well, in 2005, China offered pandas to Taiwan, okay? And I think it because the chairman of the Kuomintang, Lian Zhan, was visiting mainland China, which was a big signal of, like, corporations between two.
Interstate
more interactions and more, yeah, connections. So the idea was popular, apparently, with the Taiwanese public after, you know, some polling. Like, people like pandas.
Yeah, why not?
And why not? And zoos, of course, wanted it. For generating income and, you know, make them popular and look good. But the government, because now we have a democratic government in Taiwan, listen to our episode on Taiwan democracy, how it became.
Mm-hmm.
Democratic Progressive Party obviously was not happy with it, because to them it seemed like a signal of just China trying to, like, again, take, like, saying that Taiwan's part of it.
Mm.
Although I would say, like, I mean, China only give pandas to other countries. Because why else would you need to give them? Otherwise, you're just moving them from provinces to provinces.
Mm.
Although the names of the pandas was Tuan Tuan and Yuan Yuan. In translation, reunion. So, you know, so it's a
Wait,
weird situation.
Wait, they're both named reunion?
No, Tuan Tuan and Yuan Yuan together. Tuan Yuan in Chinese means reunion. And the names were supposedly voted by the Chinese people.
I bet.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, it could be, but... But still, it's highly political, a name like that, seeing from the Taiwanese side. And China has this rhetoric of like, 两岸一家亲, meaning like the two sides of the strait is one family, right? We all speak the same language, got the same culture. There's only one China, so let's just get along, right? But of course, we can't get along if you have like missiles pointed at one side at all times. So it's highly political, it's very controversial, but eventually the pandas did go to Taiwan. And I think they produce little pandas. So one more thing I want to mention, which again, maybe deserves its own episode. So now that panda is no longer endangered, they're vulnerable. And in many Chinese zoos, they have pandas right all over the place. You know, Shenzhen Zoo would have a panda, you know, some zoo in Chengdu would have a panda. And
so within panda, it's no longer exotic to have pandas somewhere. Very low level zoos could have pandas.
not low-level zoos, but, you know, more than a handful of zoos in China would have pandas. That's and it. Worldwide. It's not like there's only five of them to go around everywhere. So, but the thing about Chinese industry or Chinese zoos or anything is that regulation, even if they exist, is not a real thing. It's not strictly, it may not likely be strictly followed. So,
I mean, it probably isn't a place like Shanghai.
Well, I mean, it is, Beijing. Yeah, but it's very, it depends.
Yeah.
Right? And so news about
the
pandas.
The heavens are high and the emperor's far away.
Exactly. So news about pandas getting mistreated would go viral sometimes on the Chinese social media. And there will be cameras, like security cameras, of like the panda caretakers throw bamboos at pandas, like in their face, or like, like kick them, like, and it's all caught on camera. And like zoo visitors would often report, why does this panda look like it's got injured and it's so sick and it's like so old? Why are you showing these pandas around?
Yeah.
You know, so there's a lot of suspicions that goes around from time to time that certain pandas are abused. And obviously the zoos always come out and be like, no, it's a misunderstanding. Or they go, yeah, it was a misconduct of one zookeeper and we fired them.
One bad apple.
Exactly. So, but you know, I think, because we talked about it and you're like, that's a good thing because that means pandas are no longer in danger.
Yeah.
You know, now we can afford to abuse some of them. But that's terrible. And it's supposedly our national treasure.
Yeah.
But obviously it's not the answer of how much people will love the panda. The answer is you need good regulation and transparency.
Yeah.
But that's a whole other.
That's not going to happen.
Yeah. So.
So is it kind of, you know, is it sort of the same internationally basically as it was?
We still don't want we still don't want pandas,
so it's still panda loans. All the baby pandas belong to China.
Yeah, hasn't changed.
Interesting.
So we basically still have a monopoly.
So basically every panda in the world, as far as you know, is essentially Chinese property.
Most all of them, I think.
Yeah,
I don't know if there are exceptions. There might be here and there,
but
I don't think anyone else has a panda population that's readily to go.
Yeah. Well, I guess my takeaway is, if you do go to a zoo and you do see pandas, keep in mind that more so than possibly any other animal, how that panda got there is an intensely political process.
Yeah.
There is no panda that just appeared in a zoo worldwide. It all involved dealing with and lots of contracts and negotiations with the Chinese government, which think is very interesting.
Yes. And obviously that goes, because sometimes I feel conflicted about it, because that goes to the ethical question of what preservation is and animal rights, right? And you know, if you believe in the data, a panda in the wild lives 20 years, but a panda in captivity, or maybe bred in captivity and kept in captivity, can live up to 30 years or longer. Is that a better thing to keep them, you know, or caged up and taken care of? But, you know, we have cats. They don't go outside. They live longer than street cats.
Well,
I don't know.
I think the idea is you have both.
Yeah,
right?
You have
You have them naturally in the wild, but then you also have a captive breeding population.
Yeah. And you try to treat them well and have transparency that can be monitored by the public.
Well, I wonder what's in the future for pandas. I think it'll almost be like wolves. So like wolves and like buffalo.
Yeah.
You know, we're like extremely endangered in the U.S. for quite a while. But now there's like, now there's a lot of wolves. I mean, not in the grand scheme of things, but there's, you know, they're no longer endangered.
Yes.
So now places, it's okay to shoot wolves again in certain states. Because they're like, well, you know, there's too many of them. They're eating our livestock and stuff.
Mm.
And I wonder, as pandas continue to grow.
Well, pandas don't eat livestock.
I know.
So, unless your livestock is bamboos.
I know. But at a certain point, once they're out of danger, right? Yeah. They just become another animal.
Yeah.
And I kind of wonder what that's gonna be like for pandas. But until then, well, hopefully that was interesting to people. The back and forth of pandas. How they became such a political item, how basically every panda is a panda as a service rented from China at this point.
Can I put another disclaimer in?
What's that?
So obviously it's, like you said, it's a highly political process and it's very frustrating to deal with. But really there are a group of people who really are dedicated to panda preservation.
Not just the money.
The scientists. the biologists, the panda caretakers, not the ones that kicked them, obviously, in zoos in China, but you know, the animal activists, there are groups of people, lots of them, that are have dedicated their lives and their energy to the preserving and well-beings of pandas worldwide.
And if they hadn't done that, we might not
have. Lots of them
any.
Are Chinese scientists, right? Mm-hmm. And they have, and because of this process is so highly political, they are, I believe, under way more pressure than someone who studies, snakes or
musk oxen.
Yes, exactly, right? So, or giraffes.
Yeah.
So yeah, I just want to say thank you to them, because without them, this episode wouldn't come through either, yeah, without their research. Because
if you're studying a panda and it dies, right, that's a, you know, that could, that's a, it's, that could almost, that is almost a political act, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That could be an anti-China act in a way that some other animal,
yeah,
it's not.
Yeah.
Why are you making that face?
Well, because I have read, like, on Chinese social media where, like, people go, is the Washington's or some other, like, is this foreign zoo, like, abusing our pandas? Like, they're, like, humiliating China because it's, you know, yeah.
Because it's a Chinese animal, Cherry. They have Chinese citizenship.
They have Chinese citizship.
They do exactly. Kind of have Chinese citizenship. They always
if they get abused, the wolf warrior will.
Wherever they are.
Wherever they are. As yeah. Wolf Warrior will go there and rescue them.
Wolf Warrior 3.
Take them back to China.
Panda rescue
mission.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, yeah. I mean, without the people, panda conservationists in China and outside of China, there might not be any pandas right now. Right? They could have all been easily just...
Oh, they would still be endangered.
Yeah. I mean, but, I mean, you know, they could have all been sold to zoos or done stuff abroad and...
Yeah, black market.
And eventually one trafficked. Day you go into the bamboo forest and you realize there's no more pandas.
Yeah.
If you like the podcast, please rate it or recommend it to a friend, or I guess don't, but
okay.
You'd like it
this
if you
is
did.
A half-handed
I know, I have confidence
promotion.
I have confidence issues, Cherry. Well, anyway.
Well, to help Nally with the confidence issue, please rate and you know, recommend the podcast to your family and friends.
Well, thank you for listening.
Yeah,
and have a nice day.
See you next time.